When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tales, thanks for joining me for another week. Geez, that opening song's catchy. I still can't get it out of my head after all these weeks. Thanks again to Benny Walker for allowing us to use that track. There's more information in the show notes if you want to be able to hear a bit more of Benny's music. So stoked you tuned in for this conversation because it's one of my favourite ones so far. This kid, Jared Clifford, just 18, has an amazing story and has an amazing attitude towards life and really, really inspirational. So well spoken, achieved some amazing things for such a young age, and just has an amazing attitude towards life. And it was one of those conversations that I was really valued to have, and really grateful that Jared said it was okay to talk to him and get him on the podcast. So really grateful for him giving up some time. Jared is a Paralympian. He's been to the Olympics. He's just finished third, got the bronze medal in the World Championships last month in the 1500, and he is a speedster. He's fast, and he's going to be a name to hear about in the future, no doubt. Enjoy this chat, guys, with Jared. Be sure to reach out to him on social media to let him know you heard him here, and yeah, really enjoy it. Cheers, guys. Right, Jared Clifford, welcome to Tell Me Your Tales podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're. I was just going through a bit of research before, and you're definitely the youngest member of the podcast guest I've had on, and I reckon the only member still in school. So that's quite an achievement, I reckon.
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Oh, but in saying that, you've your list of achievements are just as big as everybody else that I've had on the podcast. So age is definitely no barrier for you.
Yeah, I've always kind of, you know, throwing age away and just, yeah, whoever's, I mean, running, it's just, we all do it. It's all the same kind of motion, and I just like getting in there and giving it a go, and age doesn't really intimidate me much.
Yeah, and I don't think many things intimidate you, which we'll get into later on in the conversation, but did you want to maybe just give the guests a bit, or not the guests, give the audience a bit of context about who you are and maybe introduce yourself?
Yeah, no worries. So my name is Jared Clifford. I am 18 years of age, still at high school. I'm a vision impaired distance runner, middle distance runner. I competed at the 2016 Paralympic Games in the 1500 metres and the 5000 metres. And as of a couple of months ago, I just became a world championship medalist. So probably a brief summary.
Yeah, well, you've cut yourself short because you've got so many more achievements than that, but we'll get into all those ones coming up. But yeah, that bronze medal over at the World Champs in London, I guess we'll maybe touch on that first. And have you come down off that high yet?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it was incredible. I never expected a medal, so I was on a massive high for ages, and I maybe lacked a bit of motivation in the first week back, but I'm raring to go for the new season already. So
yeah. I must admit, I watched that race on YouTube so many times, and then when I found out there was a chance to get you on the podcast, I think I watched it another five or six times as well. I was just showing it to my partner this morning. That last lap was pretty quick.
It was such a weird feeling. I was just, it was like I was floating. It was nearly an out-of-body experience. And then the last 100, like with my vision, it's sometimes hard to tell where you're positioned. But it was one of those times in a race where I actually knew where I was, and I knew I was running into the bronze medal, and it was just, it was the craziest feeling.
Yeah, it's good. Well, let's maybe go back to visually impaired. Could you maybe describe for us exactly what that means?
Yeah, so obviously there's all different ranges of vision. There's three categories that are paralympically classifiable, and I sit in the middle category. So they're ranked on severity. My condition is juvenile macular degeneration. So it affects my central vision. It's got like scar tissue and blistering on the retina. So it blocks out my central vision. So I can still read, though I do a bit of braille. But my peripheral vision is not too bad. So we race against the Paralympics. We race against other people with vision impairment. So the three categories, there's T11, which is totally blind. They have to run with a guide, obviously. And there's T12, which is it's the middle category, basically. And then the third category is T13, and that goes all the way up to legally blind. So you can be legally blind and still be able to see. It's kind of like just a term that they use. And in distance running, because there's no lanes, T12s, and which is me, and T13s, we actually run together. So, yeah.
Yeah, right. I can imagine that may have caused some chaos in some races in the past, though.
Yeah, when you chuck a lot of vision impaired guys onto a track, it's always going to be a rough race.
Yeah, and even just like the adrenaline and the fatigue kicking in, like trying to stay upright in a 1500 is hard enough, let alone without those kind of obstacles to battle with while you're doing it.
Yeah, it does throw up like its challenges, especially towards the end of like really hard and often longer races. I've pulled out of my first race because of it. Earlier in the summer in a 5,000 metres, it just I didn't feel safe finishing the race, and I don't really like hampering other people's races, and I just felt like I might have been doing that in that race, so I didn't have any trouble stepping off the track. But yeah, it does present its challenges.
Are there times in races where you've got to distinguish between like fatigue from just running super hard and then that vision fatigue as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, often the fatigue will hit me, and then like it'll hit me visually as well. So it is just running fatigue, like the catalyst is the running, but it does affect my vision a little bit. So often I normally have like the ability to kind of push through it, like because I already have a vision impairment, so it's not much different. But sometimes it's just when it's like a pack on the track, it's sometimes harder to navigate.
Yeah, right. Take me back to your childhood. So always diagnosed at 3, is that correct?
Yeah, I was diagnosed at 3. I mean, I probably had it since birth, obviously, because it's genetic, but yeah, at 3.
Yeah, and then, difficulties at school, or how was that kind of first years of primary school?
Yeah, it wasn't, I mean, I didn't ever think I was any different. My parents never gave me any reason to think that I was different. I did wear glasses and I did know a little bit of braille early on, so I mean that was something. But really, like all my friends at school, you know, they were really helpful. They actually had this thing where every time they come up to me, they'd introduce who was speaking to me and stuff like that, and that that helped. And but then I also played ball sports, like I played basketball, I played footy, like I played all these sports, and I was able to do them. My vision wasn't as bad as it is now, so like it wasn't really a struggle early on.
Yeah, that's awesome. You can be involved in those sports early on as well. And then where did running come into things?
Well, my vision like deteriorated quite a bit throughout my mid to later primary school years. And I'd done school athletics and school cross country. My first race was like school cross country, just primary school, and I came sixth. So I was fit, but I was never like a massive standout. And when my vision deteriorated in those years, it kind of became more apparent that ball sports weren't really going to be feasible if I wanted to fulfill my dream of, you know, playing elite sport or doing elite sport. So I went to a talent search. I mean, I did little athletics for a year, and I did train once a month in summer. And I did a talent search in 2012, and I did pretty good at a beep test. And a couple of weeks later, they invited me up to the Australian Institute of Sport in Canberra, and that's where I kind of started, you know, looking at getting a coach and starting full-time training.
Yeah, awesome. Can you remember what you got in the talent in the beep test?
I think it was like 12 and a half or 13, which for a Paralympic talent search was pretty, yeah, doesn't normally happen. So I think it was, I think that I impressed him on that day.
Yeah, yeah, and not off a lot of training as well. So obviously you had a bit of natural talent there that was just waiting to come out.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually did okay on my bike testing and my swimming testing. But at this stage, triathlon wasn't actually a Paralympic sport, and it is now. So it might be a bit of luck that it wasn't a sport and I did end up just focusing on running.
Yeah, you might have got sucked in that direction.
Yeah.
Hey, this might be a good opportunity just to let the listeners know just how quick you are, because your PBs are pretty amazing. So you might maybe want to list your PBs from 800 through to 10K.
Yeah, so they were all run kind of, early on this year, and I have had a bit more of a coaching program change. So I am hoping I take a lot more time off this summer, but currently it's like 155 for 800, 349 for 1500, 831 for 3000, 1451 for 5000, and I ran a 10K in 2015. I was 15. I did 32.25. So, yeah.
Pretty amazing times there. I know you're smashing me definitely over 800 and 1500. So, yeah, I've got a lot of respect for the speed that you've got in your legs.
Well, I mean, I'm not doing marathon training. I wouldn't be able to smash out that sort of stuff at the moment. So, different stuff.
Oh, yeah, I was training pretty serious for 1500 back in the day, then. I'm still 4 seconds slower than you, so I'm not letting you not letting you talk that one down at all. Hey, you talked about the different training approach. Well, do you want to maybe unpack that a bit? So it's with Philo Saunders, yeah?
Yeah, so I'm now being, my program's being written by Philo Saunders. So he's in Canberra. I'm still working in with my group down at Diamond Valley Athletic Club. So my coach, he's still my coach as well, Max Bolchin, who's been kind of guiding my program. We've been collaborating together for a couple of years. So he's kind of like guiding me still. But yeah, the program's been set by Philo. And my K's have kind of gone up a little bit, and more specific training sessions, and like more periodization as well. So it's been good. It's been a bit more, there was a bit more structure in the lead up to London as well, which I did think probably helped me get a medal.
Yeah, yeah. How many K's a week are you kind of talking?
In the month before London, I was probably between 120 and 140. Like, I think I topped out at 142. And at the moment, I'm sitting around 130.
Yeah, and kind of three track sessions a week, pretty traditionally for a track runner?
Yeah, yeah, so the Tuesday, the Thursday, and then Saturday, there is a small loop that I know really well that I am able to run at race pace around, but sometimes it was, yeah, three track sessions.
Yeah, and accompanied by a kind of a, not so much a pacer, but always have someone with you when you're running?
You on the track, it's hard to sometimes find people, especially in my area, that have, you know, are kind of quick enough to
run
with me on the track. My training partner, Tim Logan, he's like, you know, he had the potential to go under 350 last summer for 1500, but he got a stress fracture, and he's slowly coming back now, and he'll get it this year. But so I didn't really have anyone for my race pace training, which is why I had to do a lot of it on the track, because obviously a track never changes, you know, 100 bends, 100 straights. So I race pace stuff on the track I'm normally okay solo, but yeah, a lot of my runs off the track, even though they're not as quick as race pace, I usually run with someone, or if I'm by myself, I'll run a loop that's really familiar, or you know that I can do without running into any obstacles.
Yeah, I was just reading your blog last week, though, about how you spent some time over at Flagstaff. So that must have been a bit of a challenge, not being familiar and at altitude. Yeah. And do you want to maybe just unpack a bit of that trip?
Yeah, so I stayed at Falls Creek a couple of times, and Falls Creek is pretty treacherous for a vision-impaired runner, and I'm probably going to start moving away from going there. And I went to Perisher with Philo's group, and that they said that the tracks in Flagstaff were similar to Perisher, and they're a bit more wider. They're just more like dirt roads. But the surface in Flagstaff, a lot of the training is actually quite accessible for someone with my vision, and I always had someone to run with. So it was an amazing experience. We were staying at like 2,100 meters above sea level, training even higher. I think one of the runs we did was like 2,700. And there was another vision impaired runner over there, Sam Harding. He just missed out on qualifying for London. He actually got the qualifier after the period closed.
Frustrating.
Just frustrating. And then, we had an amazing group. We had Madeline Hills just before her world champs, and Dion Kenzie, who is one of my best mates, and we were all training for world champs, and he went on to win a world title. But yeah, the runs up there it was incredible, and it really got me motivated for the month at home before London.
Yeah, how long did you stay out there for?
I was there a month, so it was in May, and it was the first ever time I kind of hit weeks above 120Ks.
Did you just feel super fit coming back down?
Yeah, I remember we did two long runs, and I was there for two long runs, and we did them with like Jim Walmsley, who's one of the best ultramarathoners in the world. And he was just ripping out these ridiculous long runs at 2,100 meters. I did one at 25K at like 3:55 pace, and I was really pushing. And then I came back down to sea level, and I did the same distance at like 3:45 pace, but I felt like I was cruising. So yeah, there was a big difference.
Just out for a Sunday jog at 3:45s.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't look at my watch, so I didn't actually know I was going that quick, but it did feel cruisy.
Did you take your resting heart rate or anything while you're up there, just to see how low that got?
I never did, no. I wish though.
Yeah, and like it was a pretty good training environment. Like you've already mentioned, some of those pretty big names and some good athletes to be surrounding yourself with. But you feel that brought the best out of yourself?
Yeah, for sure. Seeing those guys, who are full-time athletes, like, go about their stuff, it does motivate you to do all the one percenters and, prepare for a world championships like an elite athlete. And it kind of gave me an insight into what it takes to be an elite distance runner.
Yeah. What are some of the things you learned from them?
Just the resting in between sessions. Like, you train in the morning and then you rest. Good nutrition, and then you run again in the afternoon, and it's just about how you rest your body throughout the day. I found that the big one, yeah.
So do they just kind of like, you're just talking about sitting on the couch and like watching Netflix, or like what's their recovery look like?
Well, some of it does change. Some of them, will go shoot some basketballs, like make sure the legs are loosened up a little bit. There's like a lot of different stretching routines, and I took parts of everyone's like recovery routines that I thought were good, and then some people just sit around, and I was having like really long naps throughout the day because my eyes were getting quite tired up there, but yeah, I was taking naps throughout the day, and it was just but everyone else was doing it, so it was interesting how that all works, because with school, obviously I train in the morning, train in after school, and I'm not normally able to do that, so it's interesting.
Yeah, especially when you're getting your VCE sorted, you can't go have a nap at 1 o'clock every afternoon.
No, it doesn't really work like that.
And the altitude, like obviously it's pretty high up, significantly higher than Falls Creek. Did you adapt a ride up there?
I did by the end of it. My first run, we did a 10K and I did 4:15 pace or 4:20 pace, and I felt okay during the run, but as soon as I stopped, I just felt so sick and really faint, and I didn't really want to tell anyone because I thought it was embarrassing that I was this cooked after a 10K at a pretty cruisy pace, or what should be a pretty cruisy pace, and then my vision just whited out for like half an hour, and it was pretty scary, but by 3 days later I was pretty used to it, but it was a lot harder than sea level for sure.
Yeah, and I guess when you're in a professional environment like that, and I know you're running, just reading your blog, with some big name kind of USA runners, a couple of kind of 2:12 marathoners.
Yeah.
Did you feel a bit self-conscious about kind of saying that you're struggling on day one?
Oh, definitely, especially on what was supposed to be an easy run. Like, I was like pretty embarrassed by it at first, but then I kind of realized that it was just me getting used to it.
Yeah, especially with 4 weeks to go, you got plenty of time to adapt up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk me through the relationship with Philo. So that started this year, did you say, or leading it up to this year?
Yeah, so I've known him for maybe 2 years now, because I've been a part of the Athletics Australia Junior High Performance Group for para athletes, and he was like, I was the only distance runner in the group really, but he was the national coach. So whenever I went to Canberra, I kind of joined in with his group. And when I made my first World Championships team, he was the team coach. And he coaches arm amputee 1500 meter world record holder Michael Roger, and he's guiding the other vision impaired guy I said before, Sam Harding, and he's also helping out Dion Kenzie, who I mentioned before. So he's probably, I mean, he's for sure the best para distance coach in Australia, maybe even the world. So yeah, I spent, you know, weeks with him on teams, and I really liked the way he handled my training in the lead up to those competitions, and it just seemed like the perfect match, and kind of takes what I want to do into perspective as well with my career, which I really like. So yeah,
he's pretty credentialed himself as an athlete as well, isn't he?
Yeah, I reckon. I mean, he's still running. He ran 3:45 in Belgium, and he reckons there might have even been another second there. So he's still running really good times, and he led out the national cross country for a little bit there too the other day.
Yeah, he's just so consistent. Like, he just doesn't slow at all with age.
Nah, not at all. He took down a park run record over in London as well. So he loves it. And he's also one of the wisest people in distance running in Australia, I reckon, as well.
Yeah, and even, I don't know him personally, but just some of the blogs I've read that he's written, like his scientific knowledge of training and periodization, and I think you're in pretty good hands.
Yeah, yeah, and that was one of the reasons why I was so, yeah, he was such an attractive option.
Yeah. Hey, take me back to the world scale. So the first time you represented Australia was at Doha for the World Champs when you were just 16 years old.
Yeah. I never expected to qualify for that. And I, you know, ran my first 5,000 metres in qualification in Bendigo, which is a race that I am pretty sure you won.
I was there that day. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and I went out in 30 seconds for the first 200, so I didn't have a clue what I was doing, but I ended up running 16:21, and it was a qualifier, and I ran another one 16:15 a couple of weeks later. And then a couple of weeks before the World Champs, we realised that, or the IPC, which is the international body, realised that they'd kind of stuffed up the publishing of the events, and the qualifiers changed, so it actually rendered me not qualified. But after a protest, I actually qualified for a World Championships without running a World Qualifier. I'd never been overseas before, and so it all happened really fast.
So they changed the time on you?
Yeah, so, I mean, because as I said, there's three vision impaired categories, and initially they had the 11s running with the 12s, but then they realised they actually had meant the 12s running with the 13s, which makes the race a bit faster. So the qualifiers changed. So it caught me off guard a bit, especially in the winter when there's no chance to really go for it again.
Yeah, and how was the headspace about that? Like, you've set a goal to achieve this standard, you've done it, and then all of a sudden it's like, I know you haven't done it and you're not going overseas.
Oh, it was frustrating and it was really stressful, and I actually wouldn't have found out about it until it was too late, unless one of my mates had have actually, he went onto the website and just checked it, double checked it, and he realised, and like, lucky you did that. But yeah, it was a pretty stressful time, and I kind of, by the end, by the time selection came around, I kind of, you know, realised or resigned myself to the fact that I wouldn't really be going, and I turned my attention to 2016, but I got the call and I was on the plane, so yeah.
So good. And for 16, and I think we probably need to just make it really obvious that this wasn't World Junior Champs, this was the Open Championships, and you were 8 years younger than everyone else in your race.
Yeah, the second youngest was 8 years, which is crazy, and I've never even been overseas before, so I was way out of my depth, and it was my third 5,000 metres ever, and it was at a World Championships, and, you know, the field was packed. I think I was the only English-speaking runner. Morocco dominate vision impaired distance running, and the world record holder who ran a solo 13:53 at the London Paralympics was in the race, so, and my PB was 16:15, so I was way out of my depth, but going into it, like, I didn't have anything to lose, which was good.
Yeah, and you finished seventh that day.
Seventh, yeah. It was like 34, 35 degrees, 9:30 at night in Doha. I stuck with the leaders for like 2.5K, and then I don't remember much of the rest of the race. I was pretty delirious. I think my shoelace came undone, and I finished out in like lane 5, not intentionally, and yeah, I'd run a PB, 15:55. I was the only one in the race to run a PB, but yeah, seventh. So I was pretty stoked with that.
So good going, isn't it? It's kind of, it's probably set you up for successful campaigns in the future, like getting that one out of the way and kind of getting the experience done to then be able to go back to the next ones and improve on that. So
yeah,
how does that look when you're in year 10 at school, everyone else is going to parties on a Saturday night, and you're going over to Doha to run in a 5K race?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I was a bit of a celebrity there for a while. I mean, I never expected it. Like, if you had told me even like 6 months before that, I wouldn't have believed you. So it was pretty unexpected.
And the reason to step up to the 5K at that stage and not pursue the 1500?
Basically, because, and I mean, because we saw the qualifiers and they did look easy. I mean, in hindsight, they looked too easy, which obviously they ended up being too easy. But yeah, so that's why I did it, just because I was more in reach of the 5K than the 1500.
Yeah, and then the next time you represented Australia again, the Olympics.
Yeah, that was another crazy qualification campaign. I went in with like a PB of 4:13 in the 1500, and I was kind of told by Athletics Australia, which at the time, I mean, you can't really blame them. I was a long way off a qualifier. I needed to run fourth flat for a B qualifier, and they kind of told me, "Oh, Tokyo 2020 is where we should be looking." But my first race of the season, I ran a 14-second PB and ran 3:59, so kind of qualified. And I was on the plane to a Paralympic Games. I was like 17 years of age, and it was all surreal.
I wanted to sit here for a second though, but how does that conversation with Athletics Australia work? Did you kind of have to declare that you wanted to run the qualifier and then someone maybe just told you don't get ahead of yourself kind of thing? Or how,
It was more like, I mean, they obviously knew I was aiming for Rio. The first camp that I'd been on when I was like 12 was actually titled a Road to Rio camp. So my whole running career had kind of been to that point about Rio. So, but yeah, with my times and obviously distance running, it's you. I'm really young, so they don't want you to get injured. Overtrain trying to get a qualifier that might be out of reach. So, you don't. I didn't have to declare. They just kind of knew and thought the best bet might be to, take the pressure off me and look to the future and look to my longevity rather than, me pushing myself over the edge.
Yeah, okay, I get that. And then what do you put that down to? Just the training with Philo, the massive improvement in the 1500?
Well, I was still with Max Bolton at this stage, so with my program, and I think, I mean, I grew a lot in that year, so the big 14 seconds probably just came from, my natural improvement. And I'd been to Falls Creek, I think maybe it was second time, but my first longest stint. So it was a lot of firsts, really. It was the first time I was training like 4 times a week as well. So I think, yeah, all that combined.
Yeah, and what about the Olympic experience at Rio?
Yeah, it was insane. I actually did get a niggling little injury. It wasn't too bad in the lead up, so my training wasn't ideal. I spent 6 weeks water running and cycling, which was frustrating. I did my first run in my first session in Florida, which was the pre-camp 2 weeks before. But then getting into a Paralympic village, it's the most incredible place. There's obviously the diversity of countries, but such a diverse range of, people with disabilities doing amazing things. There's one of my favorites was it went viral, like the guy who played table tennis with no arms, and just seeing that, it's pretty cool. And then also, like, the shortest person in the village is like 60, 70 centimeters, and the tallest is 240 centimeters. So I just loved that there were so many different people and doing what they love to do, and that's do sport.
Yeah. Give me some more details about the village. So, like, what did it look like on days where you weren't competing and kind of just relaxing? I guess a lot of the listeners will never get to go to an Olympic village in their life. So, maybe share some of those little details that we just miss out on.
Yeah, so the village, it's all like high-rise buildings, and the Australian building has massive Australia like banners hanging off the balconies, and it's a really cool atmosphere. The Olympics obviously were before us, so some people joke and say the Olympics are the test event for the Paralympics. So the village, you might have heard the village had a bit of problems in the lead up to the Olympics, but by the time we got there, everything was kind of fixed. But yeah, so we stay in rooms. There's like an apartment with 5 individual rooms. So I was rooming with Michael Roger, the 1500-meter arm amputee runner. And so there's 4 apartments on each level. The village has like a 2K loop around it, so we did a lot of our runs around there. And we were about 1K from the dining hall, and the dining hall was huge. It's like maybe 3 soccer pitches, 4 soccer pitches. kind of that's how big it is. And you just sit wherever you want. You can mix with other countries, and it's an incredible place. It's so hard to kind of grasp that in words, but yeah.
Yeah, and what about food and stuff? Like, do they have a big selection of foods?
Yeah. So it's like all different cuisines from around the world. So you can kind of obviously before the race you stick with what you know best, but afterwards you can try food from pretty much anywhere in the world. I love that part, that diversity.
And a bit of a party kind of culture afterwards.
Yeah, a little bit. The closing ceremony night was pretty fun. Everyone's celebrating, you know, 4 years of hard work. It was pretty cool.
And yourself, and you just mentioned Michael Roger, like you must be pretty, I guess, similar training partners. Like your PBs are pretty close together, and he's probably, I think he's pretty similar age to me, nearly kind of coming on 30. So he's probably been a few years ahead of you, but you'd be giving him a run for his money.
Yeah, I've started catching him a little bit. There was the race where I ran 3:49. He actually broke his world record again, 3:46. So, and he ran a good 5K up in Canberra at the Nationals. I think he came fifth in the Ablebod Nationals in 14:15. So he's come along well, and he's done 3 Paralympics now. But I can't wait actually to get over to Canberra so that we can train together and then lead up to Tokyo, because we're going to be quite similar times by then, like even closer in time. So it'll be perfect training partner in the lead up to Tokyo.
And you can smash each other in training, and then come race day you can go in different races, classifications.
Different races. So hopefully, I mean, his goal is obviously to win a gold medal, and so is mine probably for Tokyo. So that would be insane.
Oh, how good would that be? 2 golds, that'd be fantastic. And has he been a bit of a mentor, like taking you under the wing a bit?
Yeah, for sure. He's when I roomed with him in Rio, like that was pretty good experience. His race didn't go exactly to the way he wanted it to. He was going for gold as the world record holder, and he got bronze. But he's just one of the most gutsy runners I've ever met. He had an injury leading into the last world champs in London, and he pushed his body to the absolute limit until he had to pull out, unfortunately. But the way he goes about it and his drive is something that I, take a lot from.
Yeah, he's a pretty tough racer too. I've come up against him a couple of times, and I think he smashed me every time. He's just so so fierce and just aggressive, and he's just, he leaves everything out there on the track.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's good. So we probably should get to your results in Rio. We kind of just whizzed straight past that, and I was too focused on what food was at the village. But so you got 7th in the 5K and the 1500, so good progression there.
Yeah, 2 sevenths again. I was pretty happy. The 1500 was crazy. There was 30,000. 35,000 in the crowd and 2 Brazilians in my race, so it was really loud. And I didn't even feel like a race, to be honest. But and then to back up the 5K off no training, I ran 15:06, which was a PB, so I was pretty stoked. But it was really just about getting experience. I missed 6th place by 0.01 in the 5K, so 3 sevenths at a world stage now after that.
Yeah, pretty consistent though, like keeping it in that kind of top 10. And like, was that call room and stuff beforehand as well? Like, what was it like?
Yeah, so we got for the 1500 was probably the main one with the big crowd and stuff, and there's a warm-up track right outside, and you kind of go through your warm-up routine, but the call room's 50 or 45 minutes beforehand, so you only get out your jog. You don't really do any strides or drills until you go in the core room, and then you go into the first core room, which is at the warm-up track, and then they take you underneath the stadium, and there's like a little 100-meter track, maybe 80-meter track under the stadium, and that's where you do your strides, and you're in a really confined box for a while with like all your competitors, and it's pretty nerve-wracking. And then also like the stand is right above you where everyone's sitting. And when I think a Brazilian might have won a medal or a gold medal during when I was in the quorum, and the stand was like it was shaking. So it was really nerve-wracking. I was shaking uncontrollably on the start line as well.
You're 17 as well. Like, so this is the same warm-up track that Usain Bolt's been on 2 weeks before, and Mo Farah.
Yeah.
And, like, you're a student, year 11 student from Australia and Melbourne kind of thing, and the next thing you know, you're under the stadium in Rio doing your strides. How did you mentally prepare for that?
Oh, it was, I mean, I don't think, I didn't really have much experience on that stage, so I was all over the place. I was, it was probably a good thing because now I've really soaked it up. Like on the start line, I was looking around. I wasn't really focused. I couldn't believe it. I was just so excited to be there. And I actually do remember thinking, I think on the first lap, I was, I'm running on the same track as, I'm like, same part of the track as what Mo Farah and Radisha were like a couple of weeks ago. So I wasn't really focused, but yeah, it was an amazing experience.
And you're so vulnerable in that situation as well, being, you know, it's not like a team sport and someone else can do it for you. Like, I'm sure your coach would have kind of sent you down the race into the call room, and then that's it. It's only you and your legs to get you through the next kind of 45 minutes until race gun, and then during the race.
Yeah, it's a super lonely 40 minutes in the call room before it, and then it's just you and your thoughts, really. And then when you're out there, like, it does seem like the whole world is watching, like, with all the colours and the bright lights and the cameras everywhere. Like, it's surreal.
Do you have any banter with the other athletes?
Not really. There was one guy actually in Rio, Chaz Davis from America, that I was good mates with, and I stood next to him on the start line, and when the Brazilian got called out and the crowd went so loud, I just said to him, "This is crazy," and he's just like, "Focus, focus." But otherwise, I don't really speak much English.
And it'd be pretty similar fields in every race. Like, are you coming up against the same guys every time?
Yeah, I'm starting to get to know them. So the Moroccan guys are dominant in the longer distance, and there's two twin Algerian brothers that dominate more the middle distance, and there's a couple of Kenyans that are starting to come through. So, yeah, I'm starting to know them. I'm friends with them all on Facebook now. So it's pretty funny that you're, like, we're all friendly, but, yeah, when it comes to on the track, we're all fierce rivals.
Yeah, till the race is over, it's always interesting, isn't it? Like, then you start embracing each other and high-fiving.
Yeah.
And, yeah, going back to pick up your bag and you're all best mates again.
Yeah, exactly. We've all gone on the same journey.
Yeah. Hey, what was the response like after the Paralympics at Rio compared to London? Like, I know you didn't go to London, but because I know, I guess I'm probably asking this question because London seemed to take Paralympics up another level, like just the way that athletes were celebrated there. I remember their campaign, like their commercial, yeah. Like, it was just it seemed to be a really good celebration of Paralympic sport.
Yeah, London took it to the next level, and London hosted it so well. Like, the night sessions were sold out, people, you know, rocked up and they couldn't even get in. Rio, obviously the crowds were a bit smaller, but it was the first time in Australia that, like, a major channel like Channel 7 had broadcasted, you know, events live. I think I remember in 2008, I might be wrong, but it was like a 30-minute highlights package each night on SBS. And then London, the ABC had, you know, a couple of hours a day of live footage. But then Rio, there was so much live footage in Australia. And, you know, people like Kurt Fearnley and Dylan Alcott, the wheelchair tennis player, they became household names, and it was pretty cool to come back to Australia and see that reaction.
Yeah, it's been good, and those guys are really standouts, aren't they? Like, they don't limit themselves in any way, and you can just tell by the way you talk and when you read your website and kind of check your Strava and stuff, it's that same attitude. So I guess you'd probably realise that the perception from the public around people with disability and sport has definitely changed.
Yeah, definitely. It's kind of changed from, like, you know, oh, it's so good to see you, you know, getting out of bed in the morning and participating in life, to, well, now we expect it. Like, we expect, you know, great things and participation in society. Like, I think it's such a good thing that people expect, you know, instead of always thinking that if someone with a disability does something amazing, it's, like, inspirational. It's, like, it's so good to see them out. It's expected. They're human beings as well, and of course they can do amazing things.
Yeah, well put, mate. Excellent. Hey, I guess next question would be, like, who are your role models in sport then? Like, do you really hold Kurt and that really high?
Yeah, I think Kurt, he is so courageous, and he loves pushing his body to the limit. So as a distance runner, I really, really like that in him. In Rio in the Paralympic marathon, he just went out with Marcel Hoog, who's, like, dominant in wheelchair racing, and they just, you know, took it out from the gun pretty much and just pushed their bodies to the absolute limit. And then Kurt's, you know, he's crawled the Kokoda Trek He's done some incredible things. I think he's even won a Sydney to Hobart yacht race, and he's just always put his body on the line, which I really do like, the determination and the courage.
Yeah, if you read his book, it's a really good read.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite books for sure.
Yeah, no, he's an absolute legend. And even like his involvement with like the Indigenous Marathon Project and things like that, like he doesn't need to be batting for Indigenous people as well, but he just takes everything on board and just represents everything so well.
Yeah, exactly. He's definitely a role model for everyone.
Do you use that as motivation when you, I know, because you've won a number of state titles against the able-bodied guys, so do you kind of want to prove people wrong?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes. I like proving myself wrong sometimes if I have doubts about whether I can match it with those guys. So to get out in races and beat them sometimes, like, it's a pretty cool feeling. But I also kind of look at it as I'm a runner, so and they're runners as well. And it's whoever crosses the line first. Like everyone has has their thing. Someone might be shorter than the rest of the field, so like they have their added challenge. And I've learned to run with a vision impairment, so I don't know any different. So I really just look at it like I'm a runner and they're a runner, and whoever gets to the line first is the winner. So yeah, that's my take on it, really.
Yeah, good mentality and headspace to have, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's focus on London this year then. So a couple of opportunities to represent Australia on the world stage, but I read somewhere that heading into London 2017 World Champs, you were going in with a whole different approach.
Yeah, I kind of found myself in the month leading in that I felt like I was preparing more as an elite athlete. It wasn't for the experience anymore like Doha and Rio was. Like I was going in with a genuine shot at, I thought maybe top five, but of medaling. And earlier in the year, my 3:49 was like 0.72 seconds off the world record. So that mentality of, I'm not going there to participate anymore. I'm going over there to, really have a crack at a medal. I think that motivated me a lot more in training and just got me more mentally prepared and a bit more professional in my approach.
And did you just come up with that approach by yourself, or did someone pull you aside and just say, look, this isn't for the represent Australia kind of experience, you can actually win this thing?
I think it started in Flagstaff, like training with all those guys, and we all got around each other after each session, and Philo would drop hints every now and then, and Dion Kenzie, he doesn't do it very subtly. He like, I think after one session he's just like, he was so pumped, he's like, you can medal at World Champs in London. And and he kept saying, I roomed with him in London, and every day he was saying it to me. And after each session in Flagstaff, like he was saying similar stuff. So I think it just kind of got into my head, and I just started believing it.
And when you ran that 3:49, it must have been just a massive confidence booster, like knowing that only one person in the history has ever gone quicker than you, and that person's going to be in the race. But you kind of have everyone else covered on paper beforehand.
Yeah, exactly, and especially like that. The world record was set in Rio for the gold medal. Like, it gave me so much more confidence. And I think if you can go into a championship with that confidence and that, not really cockiness, but kind of like thinking that you're a bit better than most of the other guys in the race, I think that does help in the way you race the race.
Yeah, why is it? I don't have this answer myself, but the 1500 at Rio and then your 1500 in 2017 at London, they seem to run them just go hammers and tongs, and it's super fast and championship record every time and close to the world record, whereas traditional 1500 meter finals at major championships are a bit of a walk early. And I know you're in the race that got a bit of media attention where your race at the Paralympics was quicker than the able bodies 1500 meter final. So why is that? Well, why doesn't that slow running and championship race translate to Paralympics?
I think for vision impaired, because Michael Roger's category is normally tactical with the arm amps, and I think it is something to do with the vision impairments. It's quite dangerous running tactically. My race in London, it was slightly tactical first lap, and it did wind up as it went. And even Rio, even though it was a world record, I think those guys, they do come out of Africa, and IPC don't always sanction a lot of the meets, so they could have run quicker in their careers. I think they might have even been able to run 3:45, 3:46. So Yeah, it's still hard to know if they're actually going all out or not. But the 5,000 is where it's probably a lot easier to look at, where it is always hammer and tongs, because people, I think racing in a pack for a lot of people is just too risky.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. So in the race, you're standing on the start line at London and you're feeling pretty confident, and when things start to pick up, and I'll put the link to the YouTube video in the show notes, you kind of got dropped a bit with kind of 500 metres to go, but your fight was huge and you just kept coming all the way through that last 500.
Yeah, I was, I mean, I didn't realise how far back I was actually when I've looked at the race video. I think I was 8th with 500 to go, and you know, moved into 7th just after that, and then 5th in the at the barrel, and I stayed in 5th for most of the last lap, and then shot it into the bronze medal with 100 to go. But throughout the whole race, it was just like this weird calmness, like I'd done all the hard work. This was just the, well, weird to say it, but it's kind of like the easy bit at the end. And yeah, I think I didn't really think much actually in the race, and it was kind of like all instinctual. And I've looked at the race, and one of the Kenyan guys, he like gapped the field at one stage. I didn't even realize that it happened. Like I couldn't see that. And but I just kind of trusted that it would all come together. And if I put in a good last 200 meters, I'd be able to beat 7th, which was really my probably modest aim, because I'd come 7th 3 times.
It's I've got to remind myself that I'm talking to an 18-year-old. Like, that kind of knowledge around race tactics and confidence and calmness in a race is pretty amazing to have at your age.
Yeah, I don't know where I've kind of learned it from. I think just from, you know, working with guys that have been on that stage, like Michael Roger and Dion and those guys, and just learning how they handle it. And I did see a sports psychologist at the Victorian Institute of Sport in the lead up, and he kind of gave me cues on how to just get in your zone and things like that. So I have had access to some pretty pretty important people there.
Yeah, anything you can share with the listeners about like getting into your zone, what works for you?
I think the big thing I learned after Rio was don't think about the outcome, just think about the process. And I found that really good. Like, the outcome, it'll handle itself, but you've just got to think about what you can do in that moment. So there was no point standing on the start line and stressing about, oh, am I gonna beat 7th? Am I gonna come 3rd? All I was thinking about was, what do I have to do to get the best out of myself right now? And that was to, you know, execute a race plan, which was to sit and as long as I could and just hang with the leaders as long as I could.
I've just finished reading a sports psychology book which said exactly that this afternoon, actually. It was, we're doing a podcast, The Road to Berlin Boys, doing one on mental training tonight. And, yeah, that was a big thing in it, like focusing on the process and not the outcome, because otherwise you just stress yourself and negative self-talk comes in if you're not working towards that outcome. But if you're working on that process, it's a bit easy to think about.
Yeah, it was something that it's so simple, but it changed my whole approach to my training and my racing.
And it really helps just being present and stuff as well. Like, you're not thinking about what happened last lap, or you're not thinking about the 2 laps to come. Like, you really just focus in the moment.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's a good skill. Talk to me about what happened when you come back. So you come back with a bronze medal, and has your world changed a bit?
Oh, a little bit, yeah. It's now good when I do my talks at primary schools and high schools and different you know, place organizations, and I've got a medal to show around, which is really cool. And at school, I'm the school captain now, so people are starting to get used to it. I don't know if they're getting sick of me yet, but they're starting to get used to me going overseas and racing. And but yeah, it's a cool thing, and it just it probably has changed my confidence in training and my goals for the future, in the fact that now I'm stoked with that bronze medal, but I'm just hungry for more success.
Yeah, good mentality to have. School captain, talk me through that. Voted on by your peers?
Yeah, voted on by my peers. I think I was quite lucky that the vote happened about a month after I got back from Rio. It's still fresh in everyone's mind, so I think that might have helped me out a little bit. But yeah, I'm doing 3 years of VCE, so 3 years of year 11 and 12. So this is my... this is what should be my last year of high school, but I'm actually coming back. So I think I might be the first person in history to be school captain but have to come back for school next year.
Yeah, but you'll get voted in for 2 years, won't you?
I don't know if I'll do it again, but it's been a good experience for sure.
Double term as school captain. Well, there's not too many Olympians in year 12 that have the opportunity to get voted in, I wouldn't expect.
Yeah.
You'd be a bit unlucky if there was another one you were going up against.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, two from the one school, that'd be something special.
Yeah. Obviously, though, that leadership and you just kind of said doing speeches and like giving back to the community is obviously important to you.
Yeah, definitely. I love sharing kind of my story, and if that can help someone else believe in themselves a bit more, like, yeah, that's awesome.
And even your blog, like, it's super well written and easy to understand, and really you just want to keep scrolling down. I was actually, when I read it last weekend, I was disappointed there was only two posts on there, because I wanted to go back and kind of tap into a few more, but I'm sure there's going to be more that come up over the next few months and years.
Yeah, I only started this website after Flagstaff, so hopefully I keep updating it. I'm sure I will, so yeah.
I'll put that in the show notes as well for all the listeners to check out. I'm sure they'll get a bit of entertainment out of that. So what's going forward, mate? Because you said you're hungry and there's definitely no post-race depression by the sounds of you. It's pretty motivating to go forward. So what's coming up next?
Yeah, so my next race, not targeting it specifically, but I'm excited about it, is the Melbourne 10K on October 15. Just because I've never really run a road race in a while, and I haven't raced it properly, and I haven't done a 10K in a while. I haven't really done a fun run, so it will be a lot of firsts, and it's also going to be the first time I trial guide running in a race, just because obviously a road race is a bit harder to see than on the track, because different corners and the road's a lot wider, so I can't really see the other side of the road, and going, you know, 3 minutes to 3:10 pace, like, it's, you don't have much time to react, so it's going to be interesting with how the guide running works out, so I'm excited for that.
So they'll be attached to you, and you've got some pretty handy guys signed up to help you out.
Yeah, I searched around for ages. I asked was Liam Adams, but he's obviously running Berlin, I think, with you.
Yep.
And then Harris, you know, because I need kind of guys that are elite runners themselves, it's hard to fit in with people's programs. But I managed to get Luke Matthews, who's a Rio Olympian, 800 and 1500 meters. I got him on board, so he's down to guide me for maybe the full 10K. But there's a chance that he might do 5K and then swap with Matthew Clark, who's a handy runner as well, sub 15 5K runner and 30-minute 10K runner.
It's pretty good when you got two, or you got an Olympian and a pretty good state representative in Matthew Clark sharing a role when you're going to do the whole 10K.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I don't think it's ever happened in Australia before, at the kind of the front end of fields like this. So it'll be interesting to see how it all works out with the guide swapping.
And have you got a time picked out you're aiming for?
Oh, I'm not really sure. I'd love to go 30-minute something. Depends really on conditions, because some years it's one in 30-minute something, or some years it's one in well under 30. So I don't really know. I just want to make sure I run quicker than when I was 15.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of the course. They go up past the shrine there, or down the shrine? Where?
Oh, I'm not really sure. I need to have a look. I haven't actually had a proper good look at it.
Good luck for that. What else is going forward? So next world, no, Olympics, the Comm Games. How does that work?
Yeah, so there's with para athletics, they only choose, I think, 7 or 8 para events for the Commonwealth Games. And the only one in my category is 100 metres. And I think I would have to run like 11.3, which is beyond me, definitely. But World Juniors Able-Bodied is on in 2018. And the qualifier is definitely within my reach. It's 3:48 flat. Wow. Normally 3:48 flat. I don't know if they've published this year's ones, but it has been for the last couple. And I think I've definitely got that within my reach, but so do a lot of other guys. So it'll be a big race at Nationals this year for those two spots to World Juniors, but that'll be over 1,500 metres, I think.
So they can only take two.
Yeah, two. I think the winner at Nationals is automatic if they have the qualifier, and then the second spot is discretionary.
Yeah, that's pretty motivating though, isn't it? Like, how amazing would that be if you qualified for the Able Bodies ones?
Yeah, it would be incredible. I'm 99% sure I'd be the first person to ever do it. So that's cool in itself. But I also think with my vision, I don't know how much longer, especially as the quicker I get, I'll be able to, you know, race at this speed solo. So it might be, you know, my only ever chance to make an able-bodied Australian team, which would be special, yeah.
Be super special, mate. And then that world record's got to be a chance to go, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if I get the qualifiers, the world record goes too, because that's pretty much the same time. So it'd be cool to get that out, which would mean that the three, Dion, Michael Roger and myself, would all be world record holders. So I think that would make Australia pretty dominant on the para-distance scene.
Yeah, pretty good stable, isn't it?
Yeah, I reckon. It's exciting. It's exciting for Tokyo.
Those boys can tow you through too, get you to 1,200 and you could light up the track the last 300 to get the time.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know where I'll have a shot at it, but yeah, definitely this summer.
Nice fast track up in Canberra too, isn't it?
Yeah, so I'll be spending some time up in Canberra in January, just getting used to the surrounds. And yeah, Canberra does have a good track. I have run a few PBs there before.
Yeah, and you spoke about your eyesight deteriorating as you go, well, as you get older and as you go faster. So what's running, I guess, going to look for you like for you in 10 years' time?
Yeah, I don't really know. Like, my vision may not deteriorate, and I mean, there's a good chance that it may not. But yeah, just the quicker I get and the longer distances I run, obviously, the quicker I get, it's probably harder to react and make decisions and things like that. And then longer races, more fatigue. But I think I will be looking at using a guide runner, like world champs and Paralympic runners or two. Just tactically as well, because so that I don't miss any moves that happen off the front that I might not see. But yeah, 10 years down the track, long term, I love like, you know, the history and stuff about the marathon. So I'd love to do that. But yeah, I don't know. I definitely don't think I'd be able to do it solo. But yeah, so guide running is going to be something that is going to be difficult to find people. But yeah, I think it's going to be a part of my running in 10 years.
Mate, hit me up for sure. I'd love to run a marathon with you.
There you go. It'd be good. I think
good fun.
Incentive is Paralympics and world champs as well. So that's an added incentive.
Yeah, I was just talking to someone the other day, like just that, I guess because running's such a solo sport, and even Brad Croke and I went and paced the lead female for the Gold Coast, the 35K, and just knowing that you're running for more than yourself and you kind of got a bit of a role to do it actually is really strange, because we're so used to running just thinking about ourselves and doing it for ourselves that it it really brings out another aspect of running.
Yeah, it's really good, and I think I have experienced it as an individual sport, but a lot of the time I've had guys around me supporting me on runs and things like that, and I really do love that team kind of feel. And for a marathon you're allowed four guides that do kind of 10k each, so that would be a pretty awesome feeling. We're having a team around you like that, all working towards the same goal.
Yeah, just a dream team.
Yeah, just get all the top Australian marathon runners. It'd be pretty awesome.
That'd be pretty cool. And I know like races like London Marathon actually have a separate category, don't they? Like they send them off earlier, and you're kind of in your own race. And like a big city marathon like that, I'm not sure. Do the other big city ones have like a category there?
Not as of now, except for the wheelchairs, but London, it's like they call it the IPC Marathon World Cup, because they don't do it at World Champs anymore because it's hard to close down the sprint again, but they do it at Paralympic Games, obviously. But yeah, so it's like our World Championships each year, and it's pretty cool the fact that you can kind of be winning a London Marathon race. Like, that's another reason why I'm so keen to maybe, you know, one day have a good crack at a marathon.
Yeah, and they go quite fast as well. Like, you see them, I think the lead females just start to catch them towards the end, and there's guys running like 2:17 and stuff, isn't there? 2:16?
Yeah. Well, that guy that I mentioned briefly earlier, he ran like 13:50 solo at London Paralympics to win the 5,000. Well, in Rio, he soloed like a 2:17 marathon, and I think he's done another solo one in London, as you said, but and that was off the back of running in the 1,500 and 5K in Rio as well. So he's... like, there are guys running, you know, elite level times.
Yeah, it's a pretty amazing. And what are you thinking outside of school? So you'll finish VCE at the end of next year, and career-wise?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. I'll definitely probably be going to uni. It looks like, as of now, that I'll be, you know, going up to Canberra to train with Philo's group directly. Uni-wise, like, I mean, I do like my writing, and I'm doing kind of humanities-based subjects at the moment at school, like legal studies and literature and philosophy, things like that. So I'm not really sure course-wise or job-wise, but, yeah, something in that area, I'd say.
Plenty of options there, mate. I reckon just by reading your blog and stuff that you'll find work there, no worries at all, with the public speaking and the inspirational story. Someone will snap you up pretty quick.
Yeah, hopefully.
That's pretty amazing. Hey, what I do at the end of every conversation is I ask the guests if they've got a mantra or a philosophy or a quote that they try to live by or kind of, go towards in times of need. Yep. Have you got anything?
Yeah, I love, obviously, as I said, my heroes, Kurt Fearnley, just the way he can push himself. So I love when I train the feeling of, pain and pushing my body to the limit, mainly probably because when I run, I don't really see the scenery. So it's more in the feeling of running. And I really love that feel of pushing myself. So just basically, love suffering and love the pain of it and just really embrace it. It's not really a quote, but I just, when I'm running a hard rep and it's really hurting, I just, just embrace suffering. I think there was a quote from Percy Seri that I've read somewhere, but I don't actually have it. Yeah, but it's something like embrace suffering and walk towards it and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's pretty inspirational hearing you say words like that. It's something every runner, doesn't matter really your ability, but we all suffer the same come race day. If you're just thinking about the marathon, if you're running a 2-hour 10 marathon or a 4-hour 10 marathon, the suffering's there.
And exactly.
It's the way you can tackle and survive and kind of suffer through the suffering in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what all makes us, tough runners.
Mm, yeah, that'll wear all crazy and just love suffering two or three times a week. It's quite interesting. Hey, mate, where can people follow your journey online? Have you got some handles or some websites or a Strava or blog that you can kind of give us some details for?
Yeah. So my blog is jaredclifford.com. My Instagram and Twitter is at jaredclifford. And I'm on Strava. I love Strava. I love seeing what everyone's doing. So, that's probably the best points of, contact as well. Shoot me a message. If you have any other questions, no question is, if you're curious about anything, my vision, my running, anything, shoot me a question.
Mate, I think the listeners are really going to love this conversation and just be really appreciative of your time today and just how motivating and kind of, you can just hear your energy levels through the conversation. And it's definitely inspired me to really push myself to the most. So thanks for giving up a bit of your time and we'll keep touching base in the future. And as I said, really appreciate giving up some of your time for free today to kind of inspire the listeners out there.
Yeah, no worries at all. Thanks for having me.
No dramas at all, mate. Thanks for that. That. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jared Clifford. What an absolute legend. I'm really looking forward to catching him in person because I haven't really had much to do with him in person, and it'd be great to say good day in person. And I'd absolutely love the opportunity to pace him in one of those marathons. I hope he was taking me serious because what a good role and a bit of camaraderie that would be in helping someone achieve their goal in such a brutal event that goes for so long and be quite a journey out there. Running a marathon in that kind of capacity in that role, I think, be good. Thanks again for tuning in. We had a bit of sound quality issues there. I hope it didn't annoy you too much. I tried to fix it, but I'm a bit short on time. I'm off to Europe tomorrow, getting ready for Berlin. And it was one of those things that was like, I can get this show out at kind of 8 or 9 out of 10 quality, or I can spend an hour trying to get it 10 out of 10 quality. So please forgive me if... that was not the quality you were expecting. Thanks for tuning in again. And I'll talk to you the next time I'll talk to you. I reckon I'll be located in Europe, in Berlin. Here we go. Bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.